The date is July 21st, 1989, and we are watching UHF. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Fondly from our childhood, and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. I am your host, Sean Wells, and with me is my co-host.
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
So, this week, we're looking back at June 1989, when the movies and theaters were Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Dead Poets Society, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, Do the Right Thing, Karate Kid 3, Ghostbusters 2, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Batman, and, of course, our movie for today, the award-winning Weird Al Yankovic classic UHF, which earned a whopping $6.1 million on a $5 million budget. Good for it. I think compared to some of the other movies on that list, it probably might not have done as well.
And a warning for anyone who hasn't seen this movie, which is now 31 years old. There will be spoilers ahead, so if you don't want to be spoiled, maybe hit the pause on this, go watch it, and then come back to us to see if you agree with our critiques or not.
we discussed this a little bit beforehand, and it looks like we may not want to recommend this movie to people. Spoiler alert on that one. The tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "It's crazy, it's outrageous, it's the television station run by a lunatic." But that may not be the best description, so we go to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
Yeah, I wrote one, but I'm actually going to pull from the back of the DVD here on this one, so here we go. Weird Al Yankovic, Kevin McCarthy, Michael Richards, and David Bowie, not David Bowie, and Victoria Jackson and Fran Drescher star in this inspired comedy about an offbeat guy who turns a deadbeat TV station into a raging success. Broadcasting Weird Al's unique brand of humor, UHF is a place you'll want to visit with increasing frequency. George Newman is a daydreamer whose hyperactive imagination keeps him from holding a steady job until his uncle hires him to manage Channel 62, a station that's losing money and viewers fast. But when George replaces the station's reruns with bizarre programs like Wheel of Fish and Raoul's Wild Kingdom, where poodles fly from the third-story windows, ratings begin to soar! Can George find the money he needs to stay on the air? Stay tuned.
Yep. That's UHF. Now, for me, I think fondly back on this movie. I remember vividly how excited I was to see it. Because for 11-year-old me, Weird Al was my rock god. I mean, I own it. Weird Al was one of the regulars in my music repertoire when I was younger. And so I always have, and still do even, have a soft spot for him. His music is in my current playlist, so...
Do you have a favorite song?
You know, for me, it's probably more like favorite album, and it's the one that... Off the Deep End. That's one of the ones that I remember fondly. This one, though, I remember being obsessed with the UHF soundtrack as well, to the point that I could recite all the commercials that were on it, you know, the Gandhi 2 and the Spatula City. I could recite those word for word. So to this day, I still also say that Weird Al is one of the best concerts that I've ever been to. He puts on a great live show.
Nice.
And I mean, I've been to Woodstock 99. Right, like I've been to like a huge festival with amazing bands, and I still think that Weird Al is one of the best concerts that I've ever been to. So, for a movie to come out starring him, it was the most amazing thing to me at the time. So now, what was your past experience with UHF?
So I'd literally never heard about this movie until you proposed that we watch it. Obviously, like. I am a Weird Al fan, but I'm not. I wouldn't say I'm a hardcore Weird Al fan. My history with Weird Al starts at Alapalooza, which is still to date my favorite Weird Al album.
That's probably, yeah, that's the next one after Off the Deep End for me as well.
Yeah, I think the reason why is because Jurassic Park came out that same year, and he had that Jurassic Park song, which I loved to death and listened to.
Yeah, it's frightening in the dark.
My mom just threw out my CD. So,
did you ever listen to the UHF album at all? Okay,
I hadn't heard about this movie, and I hadn't heard about UHF.
So even the songs that, like the Beverly Hillbillies song, and you're not okay. Alrighty, well, let's jump into UHF, directed by Jay Levy, who doesn't really have any other feature-length credits to his name, except a couple documentaries. He's got one called Second City, Life as We Know It, and one called Blue Story. He's best known as Weird Al's longtime manager. He's basically been Weird Al's manager since the beginning, and has directed almost all his music videos. So when you look at him on IMDb, he has, like, 150 credits, but most of them are Weird Al music videos. It's produced by Gray Fredrickson, who at one point in his career was a producer on films like Godfather Part 1 and 2 and Apocalypse Now. And then sometime after UHS, it kind of went downhill and produced things like the Rodney Dangerfield classic Ladybugs, a terrible direct-to-video Burt Reynolds movie called Cloud Nine. I remember back when I worked at Blockbuster Video, that was one of those that sat on the shelf, and I always walked past it wondering whether I should watch it. The movie was written by Weird Al Yankovic and Jay Levy, except for the Conan the Librarian scene, which is credited to Charles Holloway. Fittingly, because Last Crusade is in the theaters right now, we open the movie on a parody of Raiders of the Lost Ark, competing with another Indiana Jones movie. Competing is in heavy quotation marks there. So we're introduced to our hero, George Newman, played by the one and only Weird Al Yankovic. And my first thought when I saw this opening was, oh shit, am I remembering the wrong movie? Did I just recommend like a terrible parody movie? You know, is it a parody movie from the king of parodies? Like, it would make sense if it was. But yeah, the opening turns out to be just a psych out, but a well done spoof, I thought, you know.
Yeah, I was shocked by how like it stays so close to it.
Yeah,
you know, and that because of that, I didn't really get it. I think it was kind of lost on me. I thought it was gonna be like, I was trying to figure out, is this the whole movie? Is it gonna be like constantly just new, like he's making fun of new movies and stuff?
That's where my oh shit came in for sure. Yeah, yeah. They've got the signs that say turn back, and the guy gets hit by a train, and you know, like all the goofy things. But yeah, I thought it was a solid parody from, you know, the king of parodies. But then the picture dissolves, like he gets chased by the giant ball, he gets swished, the picture dissolves to burgers frying on a grill, and they're actually in Burger World, and he was having a daydream the whole time. And so we're introduced to his best friend, Bob Steckler, played by David Bowie. Like you said in the beginning, don't confuse with David Bowie. It's definitely not David Bowie. David Bowie, looking at his IMDb, this is probably the biggest role he had. He did, you know, a few episodes of Shameless, Cable Guy, The Rock, Kicking and Screaming. But I'd say this, by the looks of his character names, this is probably the one that he, his biggest role. And so then they get fired from for calling their boss Big Edna a pathetic tub of lard. Yeesh. It was an insult that seemed like it was kind of over the top. But, you know, that's Weird Al. That's the kind of thing that would show up as a lyric in one of his songs.
Those are also, like, jokes you could make in the 80s.
That's true. But, you know, why did Bob get fired, too? That's something I don't understand. It was Weird Al, or it was George, sorry, insulted him. But then we get, like, the big, she throws them out, and it's, you know, a completely impossible distance that she throws them. And, you know, so we go from the daydream to real life, and then all of a sudden we have this fantastic element again, and it just has me kind of wondering, well, if they had left the fantasy to the fantasy, why couldn't they have been more realistic when it came to, like later on at the party, there's the bit where like his aunt stretches his cheeks out to an impossible distance as well. And it's just leave the fantasy where it belongs.
Yeah, there's that. There's also like the scene when they're in the apartment and he needs to know what time it is, and the guy punches through the wall and he.
Yeah. And so, speaking of which, we get home and we're introduced to Kuni, played by Getty Watanabe, who is best known as Long Duck Dong in 16 Candles. I think we're going to have to do 16 Candles so that we can. Take a look at that name a little bit more closely. I also remember him from movies like Gung Ho, Gremlins 2, and his karate studio is next door. And so the heroes get home, and we are introduced to a Twinkie Wiener sandwich. And as a surprise, something that you don't know, made us Twinkie Wiener sandwiches right here. I didn't have spray cheese, so I had to do it with cheese whiz instead, but
I don't know if I can bring myself to eat that.
It's not terrible. It's like having a burger. That's not bad. It's like having a burger made out of a donut. You don't have to have it, but I just thought I'd surprise you with the Twinkie Wiener sandwich.
It looks as bad in real life as it did on the screen.
Yeah.
Like not just bad like in appearance, but just also bad in terms of health.
So we've got the Twinkie Wiener sandwich. Hanging on the wall is a Mad Magazine poster, and actually George Newman, because Weird Al Yankovic is such a fan of Mad Magazine. He took the name Newman from Alfred E. Newman. Oh, yeah. But we've mentioned products, and that brings us to a segment we like to call Sponsorship Corner. So, normally on Sponsorship Corner, we like to break down all the obvious in-your-face product placements shown in our movie. However, on this one, there weren't many, and instead this movie features a few fake products. So today, UHF is brought to you by Twinkies, Mad Magazine, Kellogg's Corn Flakes, Radio Shack, and of course, Spatula City, Plots R Us, and Crazy Ernie's Cars. I'll club a baby seal. And that is Sponsorship Corner. So yeah, as you mentioned before, he wonders what time it is. Someone from the karate studio punches through the wall. He sees he's late for dinner, and we are introduced to Terry Campbell, played by Victoria Jackson.
Ding, 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 ding. Oh. Victoria Jackson happens to be my Where Are They Now for this week. There wasn't like, looking at the IMDb and the actors in this movie, I just want to say it seems like UHF was kind of like the dead end for a lot of these people. I mean, obviously Fran Drescher went on to do The Nanny and Michael Richards went on to do Seinfeld, but even that was kind of like the pinnacle of their careers. But I mostly wanted to talk about Victoria Jackson. Like, she's most popular known for being a Saturday Night Live regular from 1986 to 1992. She did like The Weekend Update and was notable for doing some parodies of Roseanne Barr and that kind of stuff. But she didn't really do much in terms of movies after UHF. She had done a couple before, but not much after. The reason why I picked her as our Where Are They Now is for a couple credits that came after UHF, just small roles. One was she played Garfield's love interest, Penelope Pussycat, in Garfield and Friends, which was like one of my favorite cartoons growing up.
I remember that, yeah.
And then she also had a role in a small Saturday morning live-action show called Kamen Rider Dragon Knight. If you don't know what Kamen Rider is, it was kind of a... In Japan, Kamen Rider is very similar to the Power Rangers, and Victoria Jackson had a role as the aunt to one of the main characters in that show. And I saw that credit, and I just thought, how far your career must have fallen that you went from being a Saturday Night Live regular doing movies and probably thinking your career was going to go somewhere to a bit role on a TV show that nobody has ever heard of.
Well, yeah, and she was on Saturday Night Live at a time when it was Mike Myers and Dana Carvey and Phil Hartman and Kevin Nealon, like all these people that have gone on to more successful things. But unlike the Saturday Night Live from a few years ago, where the women were the funniest people on, like Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph and all that, when they were the funniest thing, back then the women on Saturday Night Live didn't quite get the respect that they deserve. Because it's also, you know, Nora Dunn was one of the women on at that time, and I think she's another one that probably faded off into the radar.
Right? Yeah, like they seem kind of just ether. Like even female roles of that time, like even the role of Terry in this movie is very like one dimensional and small, right? Like
she has one purpose is what I've noticed with this movie. After watching this movie, I realized that I really sympathize for the fight that women in Hollywood and the fight that persons of color are having in Hollywood as well, because, you know, we've got the one character that's a stereotypical Asian character, but the only black person in the movie is the cameraman. Mm-hmm. As far as I noticed, that's the only one I noticed.
Yeah.
And with someone like Terry, she is such a waste of a comedic female.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, if you kind of like what you were saying before, but if you were to take this movie and Victoria Jackson and bring it to today, where she would be comparable to, like, say, Kristen Wiig or like Kate McKinnon and that kind of stuff, and you see the movie, the roles that they're getting nowadays compared to what she got, where it's just like, you know, you're just there to fill the female purpose and maybe somebody just liked you.
But. Yeah. The only strong female character in this movie, and she's not that strong, but that would be like Fran Drescher's character. Yeah. Terry has one purpose, and that's to break his heart at one point in this movie. Was that all? That was Victoria Jackson. Okay. So Weird Al ends up at dinner with Terry, and it's just I think I'm gonna say it now. This is my hot take on this movie. I feel like this movie would be so much better if Weird Al wasn't the star. I think this movie had so much potential. But having Weird Al as the star and having him playing the straight man is just the wrong thing. Because when you were introduced to Michael Richards, I mean, Michael Richards out Weird Al's Weird Al.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have this, you know, this moment where they're sitting at home and Weird Al says to Terry, you know, he's like, I'm so stupid. What was I thinking? And then he just turns to her and says, what's for dinner? Right. You know, and that's the Weird Al joke, is I'm going to yell really loud for a bit and then, you know, I'm going to be absolutely normal. And I just think that someone else could have been a much better straight man and not had those overreactions, so that when you have characters like Stanley Spadowski that are over the top and, you know, they play well.
Yeah.
They play better, at least.
Yeah. As it is, for some reason, like, just to go on with that, but it's like weird. I like Weird Al's comedy, but his comedy throughout this entire movie falls really flat.
Yeah.
It never really resonates the way you want it to. It always just, it's like when you watch a friend who like thinks they're funny, but they're not really that funny because.
And that's part of how I feel too about, it's like, well, 11-year-old me was very excited to see this. And I guess 11-year-old me would find it funny. But now, you know, even in this scene where he's with Terry, he starts building his mashed potatoes and doing the reference to Close Encounters, you know, this means something, and it's one of those jokes. I see where they were going, it falls flat, and it was unnecessary
because there's no setup.
Yeah,
they never set up any of the comedy. He just does things and it's like you always need to know the reference.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And so going back, for someone like me who didn't watch a lot of the movies that he's probably parodying, I just see, I'm like, okay, but I don't get their reference. So yeah. Then maybe at the time when you were watching it and you were 11, you had seen like a lot of the movies.
At 11, I had not seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That was one that I know I saw when I was working at video stores in my 20s. So then it made sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we end up at Uncle Harvey Bilchuck's party. Uncle Harvey Bilchuck, played by Stanley Brock, who doesn't have any credits worth noting except he was on 47 episodes of Days of Our Lives. And he ends up winning Channel 62 in a poker game. He is talked into giving it to his nephew, George, and we welcome ourselves to U62. I love Weird Al's car. I want one of those cars. We end up seeing U62, and the bum outside the studio, who's, "Hey, mister, got any change?" and we get Psych Out number 2. The first Psych Out, of course, was, oh, you know, it's not actually a spoof of Indiana Jones. This is Psych Out number 2, where the bum starts picking through the change and gives him $1 for the change that he gets. So, you know, that was actually a gag that I did like. I had forgotten that one, and it's like, oh, okay, he's making change. He's just literally asking for change, but you're thinking he's just a bum.
Yeah.
So, and we're introduced inside to Philo, played by Anthony Geary, who is another soap opera star. He played Luke Spencer for a long time on General Hospital. It's funny, looking through the credits, you know how they list every name of every character he's ever played. Well, he played Luke, and then he played like his evil twin brother, Fake Luke, and then he was also called Fluke. So I got a kick out of the fact that he played Luke Spencer and he played Fluke Spencer. So George is, you know, getting all ready to take over the studio, and we're also introduced to Pamela Finkelstein, played by Fran Drescher, the nanny, like we mentioned, beautician and the beast, but the only strong female character in this movie. And I love when we first meet her, and she is just on a tirade about how she has a new manager in the station every week, and then Weird Al's reaction is, "Okay, then my office is in there." Yeah. I love that dismissive kind of humor. I've always had, you know, for some reason though, that kind of dismissive humor gets me every time. Yeah. So working at the station, we've got a misdelivered package that George takes it upon himself. It belongs to the network studio downtown, and he takes it upon himself to deliver it in person so he can meet his competition. And we get to meet RJ Fletcher, played by Kevin McCarthy. He's a guy that just, he's been around since 1944 acting. He has 207 credits to his name. And his whiny son, Richard. Every 80s movie has to have an adult whiny boy son, played by John Paragon, who is known as Jombie the Genie from Pee-wee's Playhouse. Mecha Lecha Hi, Mecha Heiny Ho. Of course, also to Stanley Spadowski, played by Michael Richards, just before Seinfeld took off. Like, this is one of those things that Seinfeld would have been on the air that fall.
Yeah.
And if only they had waited 6 more months to release this movie, maybe they would have gotten some Kramer fans in the seats.
Yeah, and I mean, Stanley Spadowski is very, there's a lot of Kramer in that character.
Kramer with big teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kramer with fake teeth in. But, you know, and like I said, he just, and he even has like a Kramer type entrance.
Yeah.
But like I said, he out Weird Al's Weird Al, he gets fired. He wants his mop, but they take his mop away, which becomes very important later, of course. But, you know, Weird Al decides to hire him, and he also decides to make Pamela into a newswoman. And we end up with one of the gags that I really like is the blind guy sitting on the bench with the Rubik's Cube, twisting it and holding it up to someone next to him and say, you know, "Do I have it now?" "Nope." And he twists it again. "Do I have it now?" But we were also introduced to the cameraman Noodles McIntosh, who is played by Billy Barty. Another one of these guys that just has a couple hundred credits. His go back to 1927. And for a little person, I'm surprised none of them are Wizard of Oz, but he was in Willow, nice. Legend. He was in Masters of the Universe. So three very famous movies to have little people in them. He was the one. So it's kind of him or what's his face, the guy that plays Wicked in Star Wars. That's gonna bug me. Oh my god, why don't I remember? Warwick Davis. There it is. So it seems like it's either him or Warwick Davis if you need a little person in the 80s.
I was thinking Vern Troyer.
That's not No, that's Mini-Me. And then we have Richard Fletcher. He trips Noodles, the cameraman, and I was strangely expecting it to be much more offensive. But, you know, he just does a, the little guy fell down. And it had the potential of being a lot more offensive. But I love that, you know, like when Pamela meets him, she's not fazed by the fact that he's a little person. And I love the fact that they rarely put him up on anything to take the photos. So all the camera work is done from down below waist level, and like it is kind of a fun visual gag that kind of goes through the whole movie. Richard ends up calling her a broad, you know, a crazy broad or something like that. And so when they call the station to complain about him, RJ says, "I've told them never to call chicks broad." So we've got our first misogynistic or really bad. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, it's the 80s.
He's also the villain.
So considering that Richard was nicer to Noodles than I expected, you know, I guess chicks and broads, well, that's not that bad. Even like when we look at the pathetic tub of lard from the beginning. I mean, he could have said, "Oh, she's such a fat bitch," and I guess that would be more offensive. So yeah, he is the villain. So, but then we start getting into the plan to have U-62 original programming, and so we've got Emo Phillips playing the shop teacher. This scene is actually the reason why it has a PG-13 rating. If you notice, and it's kind of the way Weird Al is, there's absolutely no cursing in the movie. Mm-hmm. But this movie is rated PG-13 because of when he cuts off his thumb and he's spraying blood. Okay, so now I know you weren't a big fan of this movie, but come on.
There was only one part of this movie that made me laugh, and when we get to it, I'll tell you what it was.
Okay. But, I mean, you know, fiddle-dee-dee, you know, it's, I've always loved that scene. That one still got me. That one still got me. We've got Uncle Nutsy's Clubhouse is the other original programming. Poor Bobo the Clown. When I was watching it, I didn't even realize that it was Bob at first. And then I'm like, oh, Bobo, okay, you know, I get it. But some of the faces that he makes are just priceless. He gets hit in the face with a frying pan. Again, it's one of those out-of-the-nowhere Weird Al jokes, which falls a little flat. But the face that he makes afterwards, I think, totally redeems the joke.
Well, I think he legitimately got hit in the face.
I heard that, like, too, yeah.
From what I read, anyways.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's trying to make the studio run, and he's supposed to have a date with an anniversary dinner with Terry, and he ends up falling asleep, and we just have a gratuitous Weird Al Yankovic music video doing the Beverly Hills Hillbillies dream sequence, which is just what the music video is back on MTV back in the day. But George ends up no-showing for his dinner, and so we bring her to her only reason for existing in this movie, which is just to dump him.
Yeah.
You know, and because he's so depressed, he ends up giving Uncle Nutsy's clubhouse to Stanley Spadowski. And for some reason, people love Stanley Spadowski. He's got speeches like his life is like a mop speech. He's just not a very smart weirdo. And I love that he's given the job and still told that he gets to be the janitor as well. That's his condition. Is that he gets to still be the janitor.
I thought it was also cool that apparently Michael Richards, he improvised a lot of those, his monologues or whatever for that show.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. That's definitely the kind of thing he does. You know, even when he's having a racist meltdown on stage, he manages to just make it up on the fly. Even if it's not funny. Racism. Okay, so now one really serious question I have here is the front door to the station. How does that door work? There is a doorknob in the middle of the door. How does that door work?
I never even thought about that.
It's one of those things that I even remember from when I was a kid, and I never understood this doorknob in the middle of the door.
Does it ever show them using it?
No, because they always just end up pushing. I don't get it. But anyway, sorry, off on a tangent. So yeah, we're starting to see the U-62 original programming. So we get Wheel of Fish, which is hosted by Cooney. And this is the first time when I wrote down, is Cooney's accent real? I wrote that down earlier when we met him. And then this was when I actually paused the movie and I had to Google an interview with Getty Watanabe to make sure to see if it was a real accent. And it's not.
No,
his "so stupid" is, he does not speak like that.
A little bit.
And so I'm wondering whether he was told to Asian it up so that the supplies joke works later on.
Yeah, I was just going to say, later on, that made me cringe.
I had an old uncle when I was a kid, a great uncle, and he was gently racist. And he was the type of guy that he loved the Chinese food restaurant in the small town that he lived in. But he was the one that was always saying that, "I want fried rice." And so, to put on this, extra accent just so that the supplies joke works.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, but
it's not funny anymore.
No, I get what they're doing, but now it's just kind of like, I don't think that works anymore. I don't think you would put that in a Jackie Chan movie in, the 2000s.
Like the last time it worked was probably Team America, World Police, and
probably.
It's only because it's those guys.
And it's only because they're puppets, too. Yeah. Like, it's only because they're not live action. And a couple more original I keep wanting to say UHF. A couple more U-62 original programming. We have Philo's Secrets of the Universe. Secrets. Oh, Philo is just an unusual character. And kind of like Victoria Jackson, he serves one purpose at one point in the movie, and that's his whole reason for being. Otherwise, I don't think Philo is really a necessary character. And we have Raoul's Wild Kingdom. And on that note, it's time for something we like to call Bit Player Spotlight. Now, Raoul is played by Trinidad Silva. He was born January 30th, 1950 in Mission, Texas. Moved to Southern California in 1970 to pursue acting. He made his screen debut in a 1977 episode of the TV show Beretta. And throughout the late 70s and 80s, he guest starred in TV shows and appeared in small roles in movies like Alambrista, The Jerk, Colors, and of course UHF. He's probably best known for a 28-episode reoccurring character Jesus Martinez on the show Hill Street Blues. I read into that a little bit, and Jesus Martinez is someone that started off as like an informant on the show and then ended up becoming a paralegal. So he was this gangbanger that ended up with this arc on the show where he ended up becoming something important on the show. So in 1988, he actually appeared in 5 different movies until landing his role in UHF. Sadly, his part had to be rewritten because on January 31st, 1988, he died in a car crash while he was filming. His wife and 2-year-old son were in the car at the time when a drunk driver ran a red light and plowed into his car. He was thrown from the car along with his son. And he died instantly, but his wife and son survived. And the driver of the other vehicle was charged with the maximum 10 years for manslaughter. Trinidad Silva was 38 years old, and the movie UHF is dedicated to him in the credits. And that is my bit player spotlight.
Whoa. Hey everybody, Editing Sean here. I just wanted to jump in and let you know that I realize I made a mistake there. I accidentally said that Trinidad Silva's death date was in January. I think I was mistaking this with his birth date, which is in January. He did actually die on July 31st, 1988. So my apologies to the Silva family for this error. It was July 31st. Also, coming up, I just want to say that I am about to say the name R.F. Simpson, when I actually mean R.J. Fletcher. I was in a production of Singing in the Rain, and the character that I played on stage there was named R.F. Simpson. So it was just a slip of the tongue. I do mean R.J. Fletcher. Okay, back to the show.
So at this point, U62 becomes the number one station in town because of all this wacky programming they now have. And R.F. Simpson is not happy. He's berating all the people that are close to him, and we get Psych Out number 3 with Take Off That Ridiculous Thing, and he's talking about the fake mustache that the guy's wearing instead of the ridiculously over the top cowboy hat with things dangling from it. And then we get the only funny line from his whiny son Richard, which is when RJ says, "What would RJ Senior say?" and Richard says, "Help, let me out of this box, I can't breathe." I mean, that was funny right there. I mean, but it was like his only funny line, and it was one of those like throwaway, like under breath lines. So he decides that he is going to buy U62. So he finds out that Uncle Harvey owns it, and Uncle Harvey agrees to sell the station to RJ. And so RJ comes in to measure the station. And we have the 3 loudest outfits ever, because, you know, Weird Al started the movie off wearing suits to work, and then now he's at the point where he's into his usual Weird Al Hawaiian shirts. So we've got George in a Hawaiian shirt standing there next to Bob, who is wearing this this barbershop quartet type striped shirt. And then beside him we have Pamela, who is wearing this like weird fluorescent like tiger stripe Zubaz type outfit, but it's in 3 different colors, like bright pink, bright green, and bright yellow. And I just look at that and I'm like, wow, this picture right here, this is 1989 right here. We've got like the 3 loudest. I think Bob's even got like high-waisted jeans and everything like that. It's pretty terrible. But even with the success, we've still got Stanley in his t-shirt and suspenders, yeah. Which is something that I appreciate, is that Stanley Spadowski never changes, even with success. You know, the show around him changes. We've got kids drinking from fire hoses. We've got, you know, a little fire truck that zooms around. We've got thousands of people in the crowd, but Stanley Spadowski is still wearing his t-shirt and his suspenders.
That was the one part that made me laugh. Was when Joel Miller finds like the magic marble and gets to take a drink from the fire hose.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but the whole time I was watching it, and I was like, this is like, is it gonna be an actual drink? And then when he actually unleashes the hose and the kid just goes flying back,
get to drink from the fire hose. Yeah, absolutely.
It was just, One of those things where I was like, I didn't believe that they're actually going to do it, and then they did, and it made it even more funny. So
yeah, we had the kid earlier when it was still Uncle Nutsy's clubhouse that spits Weird Al, and that right there almost kind of tells you, yeah, that's the movie you're in for. But that kid was trying not to laugh the whole time after with the spit hanging on. Okay, so you laughed at the fire hose. Okay. Well,
I like physical comedy.
You like physical comedy? Okay. And so we start to see like the 80s montage of how U-62 is getting popular. So we've got Town Talk with the transvestite Nazi hookers next time on Town Talk with George, you know, and we have like a Jerry Springer type fight breakout between Ku Klux Klan members and everything like that. Apparently there was a deleted scene for a show that they called Those Darn Homos. So you know, this Town Talk with George is kind of where they push the envelope the most, I think, with borderline offensive or borderline, you know, questionable characters. But so I'm kind of glad that they decided to delete Those Darn Homos. but then we also see Gandhi 2.
Yes.
And Gandhi 2, Gandhi in this is played by Jay Levy, the director of the movie. Jay Levy, I googled ethnicities, yeah, all that sort of stuff with him. And as far as I can tell, he's a white guy, and he's doing brownface. Now, our prime minister got in trouble for the same thing about 6 months ago. I don't think this is okay. I'm wondering, is it because the director said that I do a pretty mean Gandhi impression? Or was it just because they had no one else and instead of, you know, hiring someone else, they're like, he's just like, I'll just do it.
Yeah.
Like, it's...
I think, honestly, it's just one of those things where they thought about it and they thought, man, it would be funny to have Gandhi 2. Like, Gandhi 2 as a thing is funny. And then they were like, well, who's going to do it? And we can't have Weird Al do it because he's already got a thing.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like anybody could have been in that role. Well, and it's just a product of the time.
Yeah, the movie Gandhi itself, I mean, it's Ben Kingsley playing him. And yeah. So, is Ben Kingsley... I don't think he is by any means Indian or anything like that. Like, is he half? Like, so, or is it just the times that it was a white guy playing Gandhi? But, you know, by 1989, they should have known that that's not okay.
I don't know. Yeah. Like, I don't think it's okay to do. I don't think it was like technically okay then, but it was definitely acceptable by like mainstream society then, I think.
I mean, you take a look at something like Tropic Thunder.
Yeah.
Where you have Robert Downey Jr. playing the actor that is so egotistical and so method that he actually gets like skin pigmentation changed so that he can play a black man. And something like that, though, it's the ego of the character that makes that blackface funny. But
even with that, I have a bone to pick with that just because, like, I don't want to get too sidetracked, but even with Robert, it's a funny thing because he's making fun of the actor.
Yeah.
But I didn't really, he was nominated for an Academy Award for that role. So I'm like, if you give him that award, then you're kind of giving him an award for playing blackface. And then the icing on the cake is that the person who was introduced him at the Academy Awards was Cuba Gooding Jr. So then you get a black person to introduce a guy who essentially could be taking a black role. You know what I mean?
Like,
And that was only in 2009. So, I mean, if it was okay in 2009, I think it was probably, or not okay, but accepted in 2009 is probably even more accepted.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I don't know if you could even get away with doing something like Tropic Thunder even now.
You couldn't do it
with the
now.
Sensitivity.
I don't think so.
But, like, this Gandhi 2, though, the fact that they were trying to make it look like it was an actual serious, a movie that was being made, it just, that takes away the humor that at least something like Tropic Thunder brought to it, where,
It'd be interesting to know how it was received
in 89.
Like, was it something that somebody watched and people were just like, oh, Gandhi 2, man, that was so hilarious, that was my favorite part of the movie, it was so funny. Or were people like, man, that was messed up. Because I bet you it's the latter.
Well, like I said, I used to have the album for the soundtrack album, and I had these commercials memorized. Yeah. Don't move. Dirtbag, I remember that, even without being able to put the picture to it, I remember knowing the whole thing and, but yeah, it would be interesting to see how that was received. So, verdict is that, Gandhi 2, not okay, racist, yes, not okay. Brown face, yeah, not okay. That is, I used to like this one, approved behavior is no brown face. So now we find out that U-62 is going to be sold, and George is unhappy about this. So what does he do? The most 80s thing you can do. He has a telethon to save the station, and he's going to sell shares to the station so that it can be publicly owned. Now, here's my question. Now, I'm no expert on the stock market or anything, but couldn't R.J. Fletcher just buy the majority of the stocks and then he owns the station?
Yes.
Or because it's publicly traded, is that different? Like,
no, because technically if you own the majority of the stocks, then you would have majority control.
So he's going to buy this station for $75,000 from Uncle Harvey, but he could just go down to the telethon, he could drop 40 grand, and he would have controlling interest of the station. Mm-hmm. And he hasn't thought of that? Like, what? I just don't get it. I mean, he has a telethon to save the station, but that could play into the villain's hands.
Especially when he's smart enough to know that, like, laws prohibit him from operating two TV stations at once, so he has to close UHF anyways.
So he knows laws, but he doesn't know finances. I don't know. But so they have the telethon. Now here's another case where I'm no expert, but I'm no expert on telethons. I remember watching things like the MS telethon or the PBS telethons growing up. I do remember those as part of my childhood, but Stanley Spagetowski gets kidnapped halfway through this telethon, and all of a sudden, no one wants to donate anymore. Now, this is something that bugged me in Bohemian Rhapsody, too, is that Queen gets up on stage in Bohemian Rhapsody for Live Aid, and all of a sudden, the phones just fucking start ringing, and everyone, we're going to hit our goal. All of a sudden, Queen's on stage. And for me, it's like, well, if I was watching a telethon and there was something that I really wanted to watch on the TV, I wouldn't want to be interrupted by making a phone call. It seems like when Stanley Spadowski gets kidnapped, that's the ideal time to, like, go to the bathroom, get a snack, phone in a pledge.
The idea of telethons and these Live Aid concerts where it's like, we're going to provide you entertainment so you call in, has never really made sense to me. Like, why wouldn't you just be like, hey, we need money. If you want to support us, like, just give us your $10, take your share, and go on with your life. Like, it's weird that it just seems like there was a time where people were just so, what was it about the event that made someone want to donate?
Yeah, I don't know. I never understood that either, but I mean,
like, why
telephones
would
you dropped off in the 90s, and so by then, my memory of telethons, it was between the ages of 0 and 12.
I think it's like a simpler time where you were like, you saw the celebrity on there and they're like pleading with you and you respected the celebrity of the person. And so you're like, I'm going to donate to help them reach their goal. That's it's like true. When you, it's like when you give 25 cents to a kid at a lemonade stand.
Yeah.
It's like you just want to help them reach their goal.
I know with some of the telethons, they would have the celebrities manning the phones, and so you'd always hope that you got one of them.
You could talk to
them. Yeah, so that you might talk to them.
I guess that kind of makes sense.
But I just don't understand the logic of, you know, and especially with this telethon, because it's not, you know, let's raise money for charity. It's like, we've got this many shares. You can own a piece of this station and keep this programming. Like, really, did they expect him to actually be 36 hours on screen, you know?
But even to your point, like, what happens if somebody, like, at the end of it, like, not to spoil the end, but I guess so. Like, when the homeless guy when the homeless guy comes back and brings his $2,000 and buys the rest, like, what if his $2,000 is the majority of the... What if everybody else just bought one?
Yeah.
And now he has 200 shares of the station.
And George owns nothing.
Yeah, and George doesn't buy a single one, so...
Well, okay, so, yeah, we...
Which defeats the purpose of everything. Like, his aunt convinced his uncle to give him the station so he could be in charge of it and, like, do something with his life. And now it's going to be a publicly traded company he might not even have any control over anymore. Somebody else might now be like, well, no, I bought $10,000 worth of shares, so... I can run this station now, George.
I just spent $2,500 on this. George,
you go back to flipping burgers. Like, you're not doing anything productive anyways.
Yeah. So. we've got the Rambo spoof now because Stanley has been kidnapped. I love when this is where the mop comes back. I love that he sees his mop down the hallway. He manages to work his blindfold off. He sees the mop, and that's enough to get him out of his chair and running. And the fight between him and the thugs in this scene is kind of funny. Like, the shooting the staple gun behind him, but he hits the one guy in the face with all these staples, and then the guy spends the rest of the movie with these staples in his face. Why doesn't he pull them out? I just don't understand that.
The Rambo? I didn't understand the Rambo thing. Like, you know, the Indiana Jones one, the Beverly Hills, they're daydreams.
Yeah.
But the Rambo one seems to be like an overlay of what's actually happening.
Yeah.
But fictitiously in his mind.
Did he black out while he was behind the wheel of his car on his drive there and start imagining this? Because if he's letting the burgers burn on the grill in the beginning because he's daydreaming that he's Indiana Jones, did he, you know, like, did he black out? Is he putting everyone else's life at risk by trying to rescue Stanley Spadowski? and actually, that is a very good point. And it's actually the same with the one at the very end as well, the Gone with the Wind one, where it's just like, yeah, it's... Like, yeah, okay, this guy is obviously a daydreamer, but like you said, the other ones are clearly... Yeah.
That was a problem I had with the movie overall, is like halfway through they switched what the parodies were.
Yeah.
Like, before they were clearly the purpose daydreams, of them. Yeah. And then in the second half they become these weird, like, almost like the movie Sucker Punch, where it's like they're daydreaming these fantastical situations, but they're doing something and completing a mission in real life.
Wow, Sucker Punch. That's a deep cut right there. That's quite the reference to pull out. But yeah, I totally get what you mean. Yeah, it the purpose of them changes, and I never really even realized that watching the movie. You know, I was excited about the fact that a lot of the fantasy has started to fade away. The fantasy that I was talking about in the beginning, like Big Edna being able to throw them the length of the parking lot or the cheek stretching. And that starts to fade away. Like, there's still the fire hose.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, that's kind of realistic, because if you sat in front of a fire hose, that's what would happen to you. You would get blown across the damn room.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a point where the fantasy starts kind of creeping into the reality of it a bit. Yeah, that's a very solid point, though, about So yeah, we've got the Rambo spoof. I guess it was just their opportunity to make fun of Rambo because everything's blowing up and he's throwing bullets at people. And no, wait, am I mixing that up with Hot Shots? Am I forgetting UHF? Anyway.
He catches a bullet in his mouth.
Oh, he catches it in it, yeah. And there's a scene in Hot Shots Part 2, and I watched that not too long ago, and it's the same thing where he picks up a handful of bullets and throws them at people. So it's like I'm mixing up the two Rambo spoofs that would have happened within probably like 5 years of each other. I'd probably go on record as saying that the one in Hot Shots is probably better. So Philo comes to the rescue. Oh, sorry, after Cooney saves the day with his... Supplies out of the supplies closet. Yeah, we find out that Philo has set up a hidden camera in RJ Fletcher's office, and he has recorded some damning confession, which I guess is the other reason why Terry is in this movie. I forgot that Terry was in this scene. But if we didn't have Terry, it could have just as easily been, I don't know, Fran Drescher? Like, couldn't Pamela Finkelstein have gone over there to talk to RJ? I don't know. But so, I guess Terry has two purposes in this movie. But much like Weird Al being the straight man, it's, again, Terry is just kind of this sad sack. You know, her comedy, Victoria Jackson's comedy is absolutely wasted on Terry. Because she's a straight woman as well. Like, yeah. So, you know, we've got these two wacky people that are just playing the straight characters.
Yeah, she's actually never funny. I can't think of a
No, I don't think she
joke
is.
Or like
no, the funniest thing about her that I can think of is that dress she is wearing while she's waiting for George at the anniversary dinner, which is basically like a combination between a terrible 80s prom dress and a terrible 80s bridesmaid dress. But yeah, so but Philo comes to the rescue because of his hidden camera that he has placed, and he ends up splicing into an announcement that RJ Fletcher is making on the air that, you know, what he actually said about the people of this town being morons and all that sort of thing.
So, I just want one thing. When I watched this movie, I was like, I really felt like this in this moment, Weird Al, if he wanted to, has like a case to go after Tim Burton and his Batman Returns, because Batman Returns basically hinges on the exact same premise.
So RJ Fletcher is the Penguin.
Yeah. And I just thought, I was like, that would be a good way to stick it, because Batman basically got released in 1989 and ruined everybody's summers. So.
Oh my god, yep. The only difference is that Philo used an actual like television transmitter instead of using a CD player with a bat symbol on it.
He didn't scratch it.
Yeah, because you can scratch a CD, because that's how that works, Tim Burton. Oh my god. Yep. Yeah, Weird Al should sue Batman. So Philo has done his job, so he exits, and somehow he goes back to his home planet. That was so dumb. Yeah. Like that was one of those things where I'm like, oh, come on. Like, you know, this was not necessary. I get it that you're saying the whole time that he's a little bit weird, but why you had to add this fantastical element again? And it's kind of like you said, is that, you know, like there's that middle chunk where everything is actually could be a very funny movie, and it's a very solid idea in the middle. But then once the Rambo thing happens, it starts to get fantastical again. Yeah. You know, and
if they had just stuck with the parodies of like different types of TV shows and
Conan
and all the weird TV show ideas and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That was the parodying that worked in the movie. The other stuff, the movie stuff just Because then I was, it just didn't work as well for whatever reason.
See, and that's where I think that the idea of the movie, like the actual story idea.
It was like they had two ideas.
Exactly.
It was like they had one idea where they wanted to be, it was going to be like two guys making like home movies, almost like Be Kind Rewind or something like that. And then they had this other idea where they had the TV station and they had to come up with brand new content.
And
then they tried to mash them together.
it's like they had, you know, like a 45-minute idea and then all these like little 3-minute ideas. This is Saturday Night Live. This is, you know, this is sketch comedy at its best right here. Let's throw in all these little bits that, and you know, like when I said that I've been to the Weird Al concert, I mean, when he's backstage changing, because he'll wear the costumes that he wore in the videos that he had for different songs, and so while you're backstage you see these little bits called LTV, and they're the same sort of thing. They remind me of this kind of thing where it's like a little 5-minute thing that just doesn't really make sense with anything else as you go. So we've got Noodles McIntosh gets his revenge on Richard Fletcher by tripping him into mud. But then we've got, you know, why are all these 80s filled with adult whiny daddy's boys? Because he gets tripped and daddy! It was the same sort of thing like when we watched Goonies. You Goonie! Like, we've got all these whiny, entitled, they're annoying characters. They're all the same. But at least someone got hit in the nuts, because in the end we get someone that kicked in the nuts as well. So thank goodness we got through an 80s movie and just in the nick of time managed to get someone hit in the nuts. George and Terry are reunited, and we've got a spoof of Gone with the Wind as an ending, and that's UHF. Now, Colin, on IMDb, it scored 7.0 out of 10.
What?
Yeah, 25,278 reviews, and it scored 7 out of 10. And the critic Metascore of 32, and that's out of 100. Rotten Tomatoes, the critics have given it a 64%. That's the tomato meter. And an audience score, double the reviews on this audience score, 50,645 reviews. The audience score is 77% on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's shocking.
Where does it fall for you?
I have a quote here from Gene Siskel that really just resonated with me and summed up how I felt about this movie.
Okay, right on.
He said in 1989, "Never has a comedy tried so hard and failed so often to be funny," and that really just sums up my thought about this movie. I would give it like a 10% for the funny fire hose gang. Even this movie, everything I read about this movie, they talk about it like it's as a cult classic. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just God bless like Weird Al. It's for the love that people have for him, I think this movie gets a pass in the minds of some people, but it by no means is a good movie. To me, it seems like, if I had to guess, I would say they wrote one draft and then filmed it. Like you said before, having Weird Al be the straight man, even be the main guy. Like, he's just not a confident actor. He's a funny musician and that kind of stuff, but he's not a great actor. And the comedy just fell so flat. And his type of comedy, I think it works good in a 2-minute music video, but in a 1 hour 30-some minutes movie, there's not enough to carry it through.
I can put your mind at ease that he does have no other feature length credits.
Yes,
all of Weird Al's credits are either music videos or things where he plays himself.
Yeah.
Or voiceover work. He does do voiceover work. I know there's an episode of Teen Titans Go. Again, I'm mentioning Teen Titans Go because I've got kids. There's an episode where he is playing Darkseid.
Yeah.
In a two-part Teen Titans episode. And they joke about the fact that Darkseid sounds like... Or is it Darkseid?
Darkseid. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that he sounds like Weird Al Yankovic. And so it is a funny bit. But yeah, most of his credits, he's either playing himself or...
Yeah. I kind of... You know, I do kind of feel bad for Weird Al reading about this movie. I read a lot of things that were where he was talking about how he was told that this movie was one of the highest testing movies that Orion Films had ever produced.
Really?
And so, like, they were expecting it to be this smash hit. And then it just got torn apart in this in this summer of brilliant movies. So badly that it got beat by a re-release of Disney's Peter Pan. Like that's how bad it did.
Wow, that one didn't come up in my research. Okay, yeah.
And so...
Well, but that was back in the day when Disney did that. And, yeah. I mean, yeah, re-releases of their movies always did.
And so it kind of just... Even though I don't like the movie at all, I did feel bad for him because it seemed like he had been pumped up so high to, like, think, oh, this is going to be such a success, and then it flopped horribly, and he went into this, like, 3-year depression, and...
It made $6 million.
I mean, it cost only $5
million
or something.
Only $5 million to make it.
It was profitable.
It was profitable, yeah. One of the things we do on this show is we are trying to look beyond the nostalgia. And so for me, I mean, I'm more torn because I have more of a history with this movie. It's not that good anymore. It's one that I know, like, I loved when I was a kid. The jokes that I loved as a kid, I remember which ones they were and why I loved them. With them, there are only a few that really hold up. And like I said, that Rubik's Cube joke, my God, that was hilarious to me this time. And that was one that wasn't even on my radar when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I'm trying to look past the nostalgia. Because I know how much I did love this movie. But yeah. I don't think I'd go as low as 10%.
I thought 10% was generous.
That's generous. And for you, absolutely seen it. I can't erase all the nostalgia of it. But
I think for me too, one of the other things was that there was no hook for me into it. Yeah. Other than Weird Al.
And other than this show.
Yeah, and so there was no... To just watch it and be like, well, I don't really know or care for any of these actors. The story was wildly inconsistent. The humor was just not there. So, I mean,
yeah.
But I could see as a kid why you would like it. Just based on Weird Al, like, liking the funny mashed potatoes, even though I don't understand it. Yeah. Liking the fist going through the wall.
Liking the fact that I could actually see a 90-minute-long music video of one of my favorite. For me, it's... I gotta go higher than 10, but I definitely lean most towards that Metascore. That 32... You know, that's one where, it's definitely below 50%. Yeah, I agree with the IMDb Metascore of 32. And I may even come in lower, but I give it more than 10 because there were at least a half dozen good laughs that I got out of this where, you know.
The funny thing, too, is even as a Weird Al fan, what I wanted more from it was less movie stuff and more music stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing about this movie is that, you know, he's not even the music guy for this movie, right? Like, they do actually have a proper composer, John DePrez, who went on to do Ninja Turtles and Fish Called Wanda. So they do have an actual composer for this movie, and... there would have been much more opportunity for him to soundtrack the movie. I mean, that might be even something that I missed in my sponsorship corner, is that, you know, this movie is sponsored by Weird Al Yankovic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you like Weird Al, you're going to see this movie.
Yeah.
And I guess $6 million worth of people saw this movie because they were Weird Al fans.
Yeah. I think it's also worth noting that, I don't know if we mentioned it yet, but Weird Al really wanted to title this movie The Vidiot, which I actually think would have been a better name.
It might have been, yeah.
He wanted to title it The Vidiot, the studio wanted to title it UHF, and in the international release it's called The Vidiot from UHF.
Huh. That's something I did not know. Well, do we would you recommend it to anyone?
I mean, if you like Weird Al, then I think it's worth a watch. I think it's one of those movies where I would say
smoke a big fat joint before you watch. Yeah,
definitely. Like, give it a try, but I won't be shocked if you cut it up. Like, stop watching halfway.
Maybe kind of if you don't know the movie and you want this episode to make sense to you.
Yeah.
Then watch it. But otherwise, there's probably hundreds of movies that I would recommend before this, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's UHF, and that's our show for this week. If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is go to Apple or Spotify or whatever app you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars. Doesn't matter what you say, but those 5 stars drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
If you'd like to contact or donate to us, you can email us at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. You can follow us on social media at iusedtolikethisone on Facebook, at iusedtolikethisone on Instagram, or at iused2like1 with numbers instead of words because of the character limit on Twitter. On social media, you'll get the heads up on what our next movie is so you can watch it ahead of time.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells. Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter in the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Thanks for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.